Decarbonising Europe's metals industry is non-negotiable. It's critically important to ensure the continent remains competitive and can sustainably support its path to net zero. However, electrifying and decarbonising industrial processes is challenging and costly, putting pressure on industries to balance decarbonisation and financial goals. I'm joined by Edina Georgescu, Energy and Climate Change Director at Eurometal, to learn more about the challenges metal sectors are facing and how they are tracking in terms of meeting green goals. I'm Pamela Larg. Welcome to the Energy Transitions podcast. Edina, what should Europe do to actually maintain competitiveness in the metal space? And perhaps you can give us more detail on the non-ferrous metal space specifically. This is your wheelhouse.
Thanks, Pam. And thank you very much for the invitation. I'll start by explaining what non-ferrous metals are. So non-ferrous metals are aluminium, copper, nickel, zinc, lithium, cobalt, even gold and platinum, silver. They're also non-ferrous metals. And we are widely used. We are being used every day by citizens, by industries. We are enablers of the energy transition. For instance, aluminium and copper are used in cables, for instance, in electric cables. And they're also used in electric vehicles or batteries. You know, lithium batteries, cobalt. Then we're also used also for the digital transition, and we are also widely used in the defense sector. So you cannot have the current society without non-ferrous metals, and so we are vital for our daily life. I'm representing Eurometal, which is the association of European non-ferrous metal sector. We represent the whole value chain from mining, because there's still mining of metals, of minerals and metals in Europe, and we need that to continue to ensure the strategic autonomy. So we represent the whole value chain, from the mining to the to refining, to processing, and all the way down the value chain to recycling, even to recycling of non-ferrous metals. So there are these metals. Many of them are sourced and homegrown here in Europe. Others are being imported. So we have a sector that is existing in Europe, an industrial sector, but unfortunately it's not in such a great shape. It's not in such a great shape, and that is because of the high electricity prices that are still existing. So that's a reality, it's a fact, and it's a continuous challenge. We are highly electro-intensive consumers. So usually we could give you a bit of a dimension. So like medium-sized aluminium smelter, full capacity, would consume around, 7-8 terawatt-hour of electricity per year. Many times they represent sometimes 6% of country's electricity consumption. So these are big consumers. So and it's not because they're of lack of energy efficiency. It's just that's how the process is. The electrolysis, that's how it's called. So highly electro-intensive consumers, exposed to global competition. We are competing on the global market against competitors based in the countries that have different policies, different regulatory frameworks, and also that have lower electricity costs. And then we are also price takers. What that means is that the price of metal, of non-ferrous metals, is set on the global market at the London Metal Exchange. So, and that is the benchmark price at which the sale of the metal starts. That means that we are, you know, squeezed between the local costs of producing and the price at which we have to, the benchmark price at which we have to sell, plus obviously a premium, which depends on the complexity, the sophistication of the metal. So that is, you know, what has turned this industry into, put this industry, all these three components has put this sector into the challenging position it is right now. It found itself right now. So, and electricity is, you know, the backbone of the economy. It is what is turning this industry. We wouldn't exist without, you know, electricity. We are electrified assets. So what the obvious, you know, the obvious in our face solution is, yeah, we need to have globally competitive electricity prices in Europe and costs, not just electricity prices, but also costs in Europe in order to be competitive, in order to stay competitive, and in order to, you know, keep investing on this continent. And it's not an easy task, particularly nowadays, also with all within the whole new geopolitical context we are operating. But we are confident it can be done. We just need to be pragmatic over here in Europe, and we need to accept that we need to take some good, strong decisions when it comes to having to achieving the globally competitive electricity prices. And we have a whole list of measures that we think that the policymakers should take in order to tackle the challenge of the high electricity prices and costs on the short to medium term. We see that the promised land of cheap electricity will be potentially on the longer term, will arrive here on the longer term. So we need to find solutions to, you know, cross the bridge together.
You say promised land because you've given us quite an in-depth analysis of the context, and thank you for that, because I know that not all of our listeners are familiar with the non-ferrous metal space. We have a situation where they are facing so many challenges, these industrial sectors, and of course non-ferrous metals specifically. You used the word squeezed, which I think is really appropriate. Because, you know, you're trying to remain competitive, you know, you have costly electricity prices. Are we seeing Europe's metal industries within this context being pushed beyond what they are capable of, specifically when it comes to decarbonization goals? Because that is obviously central amidst the efforts to remain competitive as well.
I think we're getting to that point. That is true. We're getting to that point, and I'll explain why. I mean, 80, the non-ferrous metals industry, the sector in Europe, has reduced their greenhouse gas emissions since 1990 by more than 60%. It's more than 60% of the whole of the total emissions. 81% of that is coming from the electricity we consume. So 81% are what we call scope 2 emissions. The rest is direct emissions or the third scope 3, like transport or whatever. So in order to decarbonize, we need to consume, decarbonized, green, low carbon electricity. And we are 81% there. There would be, you know, only 19 left. So we're almost there. And we are investing heavily because in energy efficiency. As I said, we reduced our emissions. So we have also invested heavily in reducing the direct emissions. It's just the indirect emissions that are outside our reach, they're outside our power, because we don't control the political decisions of countries when they decide their energy mix. We also do not. So we need to have access to cheap, affordable, globally competitive, because we're competing on global markets, electricity. So energy efficiency, being highly electro-intensive, there's an inherent, you know, drive, internal drive to reduce the electricity consumption. That is just good business. We don't need, this is happening without any targets or without any regulation. It's just good business. You consume less electricity, obviously your costs go down. Obviously, these investments in energy efficiency, you know, they have to also deliver the savings that make them worth. And we see that, you know, that is being, you know, we're also getting to a point where it becomes, investing in energy efficiency becomes too costly for the savings that delivers. We're reaching, you know, we stretched as far as we can. And then what we have, if we look, you know, further to fully decarbonize, there are all these still nascent, if you want, technologies that, you know, we would need to use, like CCS or hydrogen, which are extremely expensive, which we can't afford. And also, we are reaching for different technologies, for different types of sectors. There's no technology to decarbonize yet that can deliver that decarbonization that we need. So I think there's one thing to be ambitious, to be ambitious, that's fine. Being ambitious is fine. It's just that sometimes reality, when it comes, particularly the technological reality, it doesn't match the ambition. It's good to dream. It's obviously good. That's how a lot of, you know, discoveries, a lot of inventions happened. But we also need to, you know, invest more money in Europe into development of technology, into innovation. But we need that innovation to happen organically. Not just in a lab or in a university that stays there and doesn't make the jump into the business or into the commercial sector. We need that innovation to happen organically, particularly in companies, in plants, in industrial activities where, you know, it happens because it is, linked to, is based on all the knowledge that has been built there. It's based on the technical understanding. It's also based on the commercial understanding and the business understanding. So we need all these elements to happen, to be in one place, and that delivers research and development and innovation. And this is, you know, a negative side of the deindustrialization. It's a hard word to say. It's actually a very negative word to say, deindustrialization. But this is what we've been seeing in Europe. Slowly, but surely, the size of the industry in Europe has decreased every year. That has the negative effect of that is that investment is not happening. CEOs, boards, shareholders, they're more reluctant when they see that to invest into, let's modernize, let's put more money into here, let's invest in innovation or research and development, since if they don't know if there is really a future for that investment here. So what we need to do is to create the business case for industry to stay and to thrive here in Europe, and that will come, that will bring organically the innovation, that will also bring investment in research and development, because it's just a good business to do that. That will create jobs, that will give generations of engineers a place to work. It will also keep the economic development, or it will even bring growth to regions of Europe that right now they're looking at a potential high unemployment, various social problems. So usually these plants, non-ferrous metals and the sector, they're located in mono-industrial areas, and a lot of other plants or industrial assets have been built around them, because you have you have the production, the supplier of metal there. And the unknown effect, I think the aspect that few people talk about, is that when such plant is closing, the other ones can also fade away, are also at risk. So I would just not take all this lightly, particularly we have to mention the geopolitical context. We see that we can no longer rely on the suppliers of such metals that we have been relying so far. So we need to have this production here in Europe to also secure our people and our economy.
Adina, I think it's an important point that you're making here, because we have a situation where it comes down to competitiveness, and the fact that if we don't ensure European competitiveness, the ripple effects will be far felt. I think my question to you is, will we be able to decarbonize and then actually boost competitiveness because we are in the process of decarbonizing? Would that give us some kind of competitive advantage in Europe, perhaps?
I think, these two, they have to be married together, competitiveness and decarbonization. So it just has to happen. It's just that it will cost us a lot of money. And we need to accept this. This is part of the reality. All kinds of decarbonization is not cheap. Technologies that are just coming on the market, they're also not cheap. So all this is going to cost everyone, from household consumers, from every citizen to companies, and all kinds of companies. It's going to cost them a lot. And we need to find a way to offset the costs. So for that, there are various solutions. We bring money from the private sector. We are looking into subsidies. As Europe, we have the European budget, the upcoming multi-annual financial framework that is looking to that. We can bring all kinds of hedge funds, investment funds to put money to make such investments. But everyone will eventually, all these private sector investments, they will be looking at, is this a good business for me? So we also need to make sure that, the products that are coming out, the decarbonized products, if you wish, they're also competitive on the market, on the global market. So for that, either we need everyone in the world to, you know, follow the same approach, to also, you know, to have, well, more or less the same costs, or we are going to need to spend, you know, to create what we call lead markets. So that would be those would require having these lead markets. Creating these lead markets would require measures that are enticing the consumption and the demand of these decarbonized products that are inherently more expensive. So there are various ways to do it, either through public procurement rules or through what we call carbon contracts for difference. So there are ways to do that. But I think we all need to be aware that this is going to cost. It's not happening without everything. Is life is about paying a price.
It all comes down to the bottom line. Just briefly, Adina, you did touch on hydrogen and specifically CCS. It would be interesting to understand, is there uptake? Is there interest in these kinds of nascent technologies? Or is it still too early to tell?
Well, my sector has done several decarbonization pathways. So they've looked to also have a whole sectoral decarbonization, the transition pathway, we call it. Obviously, the uptake of these technologies and the variety, the choice of decarbonization technologies will depend on each sector. So you would see that there would be a difference between decarbonizing the, I don't know, copper sector, for instance, compared to aluminium, or they have different challenges. What they do have in common, all of them, is the electricity consumption. So for all of non-ferrous metals, if you're decarbonizing the electricity consumption, you're almost there. And for the rest, there would be a variety of technologies that would have to be used to further decarbonize. What we see right now is that, you know, they are not yet there, these technologies. And beyond, I don't know, depends on the technology, beyond the technical challenges, beyond, I don't know, like the social acceptability challenges and all these things, I think the biggest challenge is the cost of such technologies. And in order to use them, the plant, you know, the industrial consumer needs to have very deep pockets to use those technologies right now. So either we, you know, improve their market deployment of these technologies so that they become cheaper and widespread, or we would be looking into, I know, different other solutions. And as I said, the choice of either hydrogen or CCS or other technologies, that depends on each sector, but I think it will also depend on the location of each plant, particularly when it comes to CCS.
Indeed. One final question. You participated at European Industrial Energy Days last year, and obviously its core focus is decarbonizing industry and overcoming the challenges associated with that. It would be interesting to know what was one of the key takeaways from that. And you're obviously participating again this year, which is very exciting. What are you looking forward to?
I think the key takeaways was that, you know, we were all united. You know, the industry was all united on the challenges, and also all united on the direction we are going. So there's no, you know, debate whether or not you know, decarbonization should or should not happen. There's no debate over that. I mean, it's clear the direction is there. I think it is how to overcome the challenges that is the key aspect. And I remember that there wasn't a panel where the high electricity prices and or high energy prices and costs was not mentioned. So evidently we are still there. We're still facing this, and also acknowledging this is, you know, we are halfway there. If we acknowledge that we are living in this kind of situation over here in Europe, then we would be, I think, more open to find solutions than, you know, ignoring the problem. So I think that was for me the key takeaway, and I think the unity of the industry being all united, you know, having the same problem brings you together, but also going in the same direction keeps you together.
Well, it's been such a pleasure. Adina, thank you so much for sharing your insights.
Well, thanks a lot for the invitation and for the opportunity.
For more insights, join the Enlit community.